podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take 2. Me, Martinez. That big football stadium is already changing the city of Englewood. Property values are spiking, and so are rent prices. We'll hear how a rent cap could preserve the community spirit of Englewood. Plus, if you have a low-level felony conviction, you can't...
I can't sell real estate, can't sell used cars, can't sell insurance when my son grows up, can't chaperone his field trips.
But soon, clearing criminal records could be a lot more streamlined. It's ahead on Take 2.
Podcast supported by Spectrum News One. Hosts Alex Cohen and Amrit Singh provide a deeper look at the issues affecting Southern Californians and their communities on Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. Me, Martinez. Thanks for lending us your ears for the next hour or so. All right, coming up on today's show, we look at a couple of different barriers facing college-bound students, including a lack of affordable housing. But first, to Englewood, where an economic boom is in the works. With a new sports stadium on the way, as well as new transit projects, property values have increased. But that's also sent some rents through the roof. In some cases, they've increased as much as 140%. So yesterday, the Englewood City Council voted to impose a cap. The original proposal said rents couldn't increase more than 8% over the course of 1 year. But after public comments at yesterday's council meeting, officials decided on a 5% cap. And there are some provisions that say landlords have to give tenants money to relocate if they can't afford a rent hike. There's one more vote before the rules take effect, but renter advocates call the decision a victory. One of them is D'Artagnan Scorza. He's a founder of Uplift Englewood, an organization that's pushed for rent control there. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're a bit of an anomaly because you actually own a home in Englewood. It's not often to see a homeowner in favor of rent control. So why were you pushing for that?
Well, you know, you're right. As a homeowner, I certainly have a set of interests that you might initially think are inconsistent with what tenants or renters need, but I don't agree with that at all. I grew up here in Englewood. My family also experienced rent increases, and we were evicted. And so we moved around. At some point, we had to even live in my mom's car and go visit a shelter. And so I understand the plight that people are dealing with. I think in addition to that, we have to make sure that folk who are most vulnerable are taken care of so that they have access to the many amenities that are coming as a result of this development that's occurring right now in the city.
Yeah, so tell us about that, because you mentioned you're born and raised in Englewood. What kind of changes have you seen in your neighborhood so far because of this massive football structure that's being built there?
Well, you know, I think folk often forget that Englewood had a racetrack back in the day. We've taken pride in our ability to host big things and to do big things in this community. But in more recent years, I have found that people that have lived here are being displaced. And so I think what's different from back when we had the racetrack, when the Kings and the Lakers played here in Englewood, is that you have large corporate owners that have come in and driven up the cost of homes. Especially when it comes to people of color, if we're thinking about racial equity, we have to make sure that we provide access to home ownership and ensure that people can afford to live here when wages have stagnated.
So this rent cap, do you see this as taking back your community, as taking back your city?
You know, I think the rent cap is a step in the right direction, but it's not enough. I think what will help us maintain this community is a set of policies. And so we need affordable housing programs. The city has not met its affordable housing goals. We need home ownership programs. Rent control is only a temporary solution.
We're talking to D'Artagnan Scorza. He's founder of Uplift Englewood, an organization that's been pushing for rent control in Englewood. There's a lot going on in Englewood. I'm sure, D'Artagnan, you are well aware. The new stadium for the Rams and Chargers, the renovated Forum, Metro Line extension. Are rising property values and rents just kind of a big part of the price of welcoming all this development?
I think that there are models out there in our society and in our country where big box development and retail are not the only ways, you know, where you can see investments in the community. For example, out in Claremont, they have enterprise zones that provide preferences for local homeowners and local entrepreneurs. So I think you can bring in stadium deals. You can bring in larger corporate investments if you do it in the right way and if you prioritize benefits for local residents and for the people that have been here for years.
Now, the move yesterday by the city council replaces an emergency ordinance from earlier this year. That one froze all rent increases. What's the reaction that you've seen from landlords and renters to these kinds of moves by officials to keep rents in check?
Well, I think you find that some homeowners, especially our mom and pops, were concerned because they didn't understand how this would affect them. But fortunately, with this ordinance, many of our mom-and-pop homeowners are being excluded from a rent cap. It's really the big corporate landlords that we were focused on, the ones who are purchasing up five or more units here in the city. Those are the folk who are coming in and raising rents by 140%.
D'Artagnan, wondering when this stadium opens next fall of 2020. For football games, it's going to be 70,000 folks walking through your neighborhood, through your city. When the Olympics are here, it's going to expand to 100,000 seats. And that's in addition to all of the different events that are going to be happening in Inglewood as a result of the structure being there. Are you excited or are you dreading this?
I know a lot of people are really concerned about traffic. You know, with the forum currently, we already have significant traffic issues. And so I know a lot of homeowners are very concerned about it. We're not happy about the pollution that's going to bring. But I think we also recognize there's a lot of civic pride in being champions and in hosting Angelenos who want to come to our city. It's sort of a mixed bag.
One more thing, D'Artagnan. Let's fast forward to 2028. The Olympics are in town. If we're having this conversation again, you and me, that many years into the future, what kind of Inglewood do you hope to see and be living in then?
I hope to see and expect us to have an Inglewood which is still serving African-American Latino residents, that folk that have been here for years are able to say. But I also want to make sure that we have space to welcome in others who want to live here and be a part of our community, right? That we focus on investing in people and not just putting profit over the needs of our residents.
D'Artagnan Scorza is the founder of the rent control advocacy group Uplift Inglewood. D'Artagnan, thanks a lot for the time.
Thank you again.
All right, staying with affordable housing, picture a community college, and you might imagine mid-sized buildings surrounded by large parking lots. Housing isn't usually a part of that picture, but as the housing crunch worsens, some schools could soon be turning to those parking lots into dorms. And they won't be just for students who want to move out of their parents' houses or cut down on their commutes. For students experiencing homelessness, having a place to stay near campus could make a huge difference, especially when it comes to academic success. Felicia Mello is a reporter for the news website Cal Matters, and she recently wrote about housing on community college campuses. Felicia, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. Now, how much are students affected by their housing situations, especially if they're in an insecure situation?
Well, it's obviously important. You know, I've heard anecdotally from students talking to them. They say, you know, it's hard to focus on writing my paper or studying for my midterm when I don't even know where I'm going to sleep at night. In terms of data, we have limited data on how much difference it makes to provide housing to community college students. But we do have some evidence that it can make a difference, numerically speaking. There's a college in Washington State called Tacoma Community College that partnered with the local housing authority to provide housing assistance for students. And they found some pretty staggering differences between the students who were able to access the housing assistance. The vast majority of them, nearly 95%, were still enrolled in school a year later. And those that were on the wait list that didn't get the assistance, only a quarter of them were still enrolled.
You know, Felicia, I went to a community college in 1988. That's when I graduated high school. And then that following fall, I went to LA City College. The first person I met, if you can believe it, was a guy who was living in his car. This is 1988, a long, long
wow.
time ago. So it's not a new thing necessarily. And you mentioned in your Cal Matters article that one in five students in the LA Community College District experience homelessness. So that number seems high. So I just want to know right off the bat, what's the basis for that statistic?
Sure. Well, most of these statistics that you hear, they come from surveys of students. So these are students self-reporting about their situation. And they're being asked things like, in the last year, did you ever stay at a shelter? Did you stay at a weekly motel because you didn't have anywhere else to go? Were you couch surfing because you didn't have anywhere else to go? There have certainly been some critiques of these surveys that the way students are solicited to participate leads to students who are struggling being more likely to fill out the survey. For example, if you say to students, you know, we want to find out about the struggles of college students, will you help us fill out this survey? You know, some might say that students who are experiencing problems are more likely to fill it out. But we do know that, you know, a lot of these surveys do have pretty big sample sizes, and the findings have been repeated. So the, you know, there was an original survey that was just the Los Angeles Community College District that, as you mentioned, found that 1 in 5 students were homeless. And, you know, there was some thought, well, maybe that's, you know, the problem is extreme in LA. LA has an obvious homelessness problem, yeah, right? But there was a recent survey just this year performed by researchers at Temple University in coordination with the California Community College student, California Community Colleges as a whole. And it was about 40,000 students on half or so of the campuses in the system. And the findings were the same, that in fact, 1 in 5 students were reporting homelessness. So, you know, I think what we can say is the bottom line is this is a significant problem. The measurements probably aren't precise, but we know that this is happening and it's probably being exacerbated by our housing crisis.
The guy I met way back then, he wound up dropping out. He just couldn't take it. I'm wondering, would more affordable student housing make a difference in this situation?
Well, I think campuses, some of them are certainly starting to bet on that. You have projects going up at Orange Coast College, which is the largest community college in Orange County, up north in Santa Rosa, where the community college there has been dramatically affected by the fires. They were actually already considering building their own housing because they saw students struggling with the high cost of housing. You know, this is in the wine country. And then the Tubbs fire broke out. And, you know, one of the administrators at that school was saying after that, we knew we had to accelerate this because not only was housing pricey, but it was actually, you know, almost impossible to find, period. So we, you know, felt like we needed to do our part to create more housing units for our students. And this is something that you, you know, are hearing from districts statewide who are looking into this, including the Los Angeles Community College District as well.
Talking to Felicia Mello, reporter for the news website Cal Matters, about housing community college students. Any proposals moving through Sacramento right now that could help students who are struggling?
Yeah, there are a few. The one that's getting the most attention on social media is kind of evidence of this bizarre dystopian reality that we're living in is AB 302 by Assemblymember Mark Berman that would allow students to sleep in their cars overnight on community college campuses. And you know, I was talking to someone who is an advocate of building housing on community college campuses, and she said, well, we could do that, you know, and have students living in their cars in these parking lots, or we could actually convert those parking lots into housing, right, and have students actually housed. But of course, that costs quite a bit of money. And I think, you know, in the assembly member's defense, the idea is to do something, you know, we know students are living in their cars now, how do we make it safer for them? There's also a proposal to create a broader housing assistance program where students would get vouchers that would help them either to pay their first month's rent or pay their security deposit. And the funding would be targeted towards students that are either homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. And then finally, there's a small amount of money in the legislature's proposed budget for the upcoming year, about $4 million for community colleges to address hunger and homelessness, which sounds like a lot. But then when you think about a system that has more than 2 million students, you know, that money may be spread fairly thin.
So it seems like there is at least a little bit of a desire to try and help out some of these students. But what are the barriers for community colleges being able to provide affordable student housing if they want to?
Well, the main challenge is how do you make it pencil out? How do we build these units and still make them affordable for students? Community colleges, because they typically have not provided housing, only about 11 of them in the 114 college system currently have dorms. A lot of times they don't have a lot of expertise, right, in the area of housing. And so sometimes they turn to private developers to help them figure it out. But obviously those private developers are also going to want to make money. So in Santa Rosa, the administrator I spoke with was telling me they actually negotiated into their contract with their private partner that the school would have to agree before rents could be increased. They're aiming to keep the rents under market at about just below $800 per bed. That's their target. So it's going to be really interesting to see if colleges are going to be able to make that work so that the beds are affordable for the population they're serving. And I think, another issue is what kind of services students living in these dorms will want or require. Once you start turning into, as what administrator said, a kind of a 24/7 campus, that means students, they're going to want food available for them during all those hours. They might want the library to be open later. And so how do you make sure that your services are also prepared to meet that demand?
Yeah, it'll not feel like a community college, maybe. That could be a different scenario altogether. Felicia Mello is a reporter for the news website Cal Matters. Felicia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For some people who have served prison time for low-level felonies, their sentence never seems to really run out. Many have trouble finding work or doing a lot of simple things that most of us take for granted all the time. Clearing your record is not easy, so a lot of people just don't try. They deal with wearing that scarlet letter of a conviction pretty much for the rest of their lives. Coming up, find out about a new system that could make a clean record as easy as snapping your fingers. That's ahead when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. California is moving toward erasing the criminal records for those convicted of marijuana-related crimes. But now, advocates and state lawmakers are also pushing to clear the records of those who serve their time for low-level felonies and misdemeanors. That includes things such as robbery, vandalism, and forgery. Two assembly-approved bills would automatically expunge the records for people convicted of those crimes, and that could help out 1 million Californians. Now, here's how the new system would work. It would automatically roll criminal records into a database. Then the Attorney General's office would clear those records after the person served time. Now that takes the pressure off the criminals themselves, who would otherwise be responsible to clear their own names. That sometimes could take up to 15 years. Championing this effort is Jay Jordan. He's executive director of the nonprofit Californians for Safety and Justice, and he joins us to explain how this process might help these former convicts. Jay, welcome to Take Two. Sure. Now, Jay, you aren't just pushing for this through your organization, but this movement could have helped people just like you. In what way could it have helped you?
It would help me personally because I do have a vehicle theft on my record that potentially could become eligible. Working, 40 hours a week, having a wife. We just had a 9-month-old son, and so trying to get down to a courthouse in Stockton. I currently live in Los Angeles. I would have to go to Stockton, fill out the paperwork, get a court date, then come back up to Stockton for another court date, and hopefully I get my record expunged. And just, working 40 hours a week, most working families don't have that luxury.
Now, when it comes to you, Jay, in your life, that vehicle theft that you mentioned, how has that on your record affected your ability to just do things that anyone else would be able to do and maybe takes for granted?
Having a conviction on your record legally means that you are of bad moral character, right? And so, anywhere you go, this scarlet letter F will follow you, right? For me personally, it pops up everywhere. It's been 15 years since I committed a crime. I can't sell real estate, can't sell used cars, can't sell insurance when my son grows up. can't chaperone his field trips, can't join the parent-teacher association, can't coach a little league team. Me and my wife could never adopt. We just bought a house. I can't join my own homeowners association. And so the list of barriers go on and on and on. And again, you know, I've exited the justice system 8 years ago, and I haven't committed a crime in 15 years. And my story is just one of millions in California and tens of millions across the country.
Now, the two bills in the assembly say that lower-level felonies and misdemeanors would automatically qualify for expungement. But, Jay, what makes the process difficult now?
So right now, you would have to, again, I live in Los Angeles. If I want my record expunged, I was convicted in San Joaquin, I would have to travel up to San Joaquin, fill out a document, make sure I have all my court records available to me, which is crazy in and of itself, make sure that I know what crime I committed, what penal code, fill that out. If I hire an attorney, I have to pay that $1,500, then I have to pay the filing fee, then come back to L.A., wait for the court date. When the court date comes, fly back up to Stockton, right, go to court, and then maybe then they would expunge my record. Right, that's 2 days off of work. That's 2 full days of travel. That's plane tickets. That's time off of work. That's time away from my family. And just most families don't have that luxury. I believe that most Californians believe in second chances. That if you earn your redemption, that if you are a productive citizen of society, if you're paying taxes and you're living crime free, you deserve a second chance. And I truly believe that Californians do not want to front the bill for just a piece of paperwork being pushed through the court system.
Talking to Jay Jordan, executive director of the nonprofit Californians for Safety and Justice. Jay, though, let's just put ourselves in the shoes of an employer or a landlord. Why isn't it important for them to know the full background of anyone that's an applicant? Shouldn't they have the ability to know if they might be hiring or renting to a former felon?
Herein lies the problem, right? The Pew study that just came out said that 1 in 2 Americans know or have a family member that has been incarcerated or have a record, right? 70 million Americans have a record. When will people's sentence end? Do we believe in redemption? And if we do, then we have to, you know, allow people to move on with their lives. And I believe we are a nation of second chances. You know, I believe that we are a nation of Christian values. And in the Christian faith, it says that, you know, people can be redeemed.
Critics of the bills say that it would be too expensive to implement this new system. What do you say to that?
When the bill was passed to automate marijuana convictions, right, automatically expunge marijuana convictions, the critics said the same thing. But Code for America came and start doing these things by the hundreds of thousands within seconds. So you have district attorney's offices like Gascon, who worked with Code for America to automate the process, and they read, I think it was like 100,000 lines of data in under 90 seconds. The DA in San Joaquin County, Tori Verber, she did the same thing. Automation saves money.
Jay, you mentioned, though, when it comes to America, that your vision of America is that it's a land of redemption, that people can find redemption, especially once they've paid their debts. What would this mean in the broader scope of criminal justice reform in the United States?
So if you think about, you know, this term mass incarceration, everybody throws this term around. But what we don't talk about is the populations that were caught up in the tough on crime era and the war on drugs. When California built 33 prisons, when we exploded our prison population to 300,000 to 2 million in over 30 years, millions of people received convictions. You know, in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s. And now what's going on is people have exited the justice system, and there's millions of people out here living, right? 70 million people with convictions, and most of those folks are left over from a failed war on drugs, right? And so allowing those millions of people to be able to get livable wage jobs, to be able to move out of the lower working class into the middle class, think about what that would do for the local economies. This affects 70 million people. And get this, 35 million of those have families. That's what we're talking about. Time Done is about families, it's about the American value system, and it's about public safety and economic mobility.
That's Jay Jordan, executive director of the nonprofit Californians for Safety and Justice. He's been talking with us about efforts in the state assembly that could create automatic expungement for criminal records. Jay, thanks a lot for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, to homelessness now. As we all know, it's a major issue in Southern California, and now it's causing a bit of a spat between local officials. Los Angeles City Council members Mike Bonin and Joe Buscaino are accusing neighboring cities of pushing homeless people out of their towns and across the border into Los Angeles. Buscaino took the policy battle to social media when he called out Torrance Councilman Aurelio Matucci on Facebook. Matucci had posted a photo of a tent in front of a Torrance business and wrote that he wanted to keep Torrance looking like Torrance, not L.A. Buscaino didn't take too kindly to that.
My question to the council member who I respect was, what are you doing as a city to address the individual in that tent? What solution do you have for that individual in that tent?
Bonin and Buscaino have pointed to Culver City and Torrance as examples of places they suspect of pushing homeless people into L.A. Officials from both cities deny the claims. A federal court has ruled that homeless people cannot be forced off the streets if cities are not providing enough shelter beds. Buscaino said the city of Los Angeles has taken steps to follow that mandate, but many other cities in L.A. County have not.
I'm just, my call to action to my colleagues in neighboring cities is to match my 300 beds. Can you imagine if the other 87 cities in the county move forward on 300 beds? We can clearly house over 25,000 people.
Buscaino and Bonin filed a motion at the L.A. City Council meeting last week calling for officials to see if Los Angeles can legally compel fellow cities to quickly build more homeless shelters amid a worsening crisis. Now to undocumented immigrants. Each year in California, about 27,000 high school students clear one hurdle only to encounter another. After graduation, they face uncertain futures because they're immigrants without documentation, and they don't know if they'll be able to work legally after college. Experts say that limits their motivation and opportunities. Only a small sliver of undocumented high school grads enroll in four-year universities. As part of our California Dream collaboration, KQED's Farida Javala Romero introduces us to one student who's decided to take a chance.
It's lunch break at a high school in East San Jose. Students play basketball and chat.
So this is my last year, unfortunately.
Daphne is 17 and going to UC Davis in the fall. We're not disclosing her full name because she's undocumented. She says she used to feel ashamed and constrained by her immigration status. Now she's trying to break free.
I think for me, college is my ticket. It's a ticket for me to do something greater, to be something else than just my status.
Daphne immigrated to the U.S. when she was 7, back in 2009. That was after the cutoff date for deferred action for childhood arrivals. So she was left out of the Obama-era program that allows other immigrant youth to temporarily work and be protected from deportation. Daphne says she's crossing her fingers immigration laws will change by the time she graduates from college.
I'm full of hope. That's all I have right now for myself, to keep myself sane, to keep myself going, to keep myself motivated.
Counselors around the state say other students without legal status are coming to different conclusions about continuing their education. Dolores Vera Valdez is a longtime counselor at Washington High School in Fremont in the Bay Area.
There's some that while they're in high school, they're expressing, oh, well, what's the point of graduating?
Diana Camilo has also seen students who are discouraged. She co-directs a master's program for school counselors at San Diego State University.
I would get some of them that would say, no, I'm going to start working with my parent, or I'm going to, you know, why am I going to be in classes, or why am I going to try to think about college when there's nothing for me?
Unauthorized immigrants are barred from federal financial aid. Some states even limit undocumented students from enrolling in public universities. But California has expanded access to higher education by offering undocumented residents in-state tuition and state financial aid. Joe Hayes is an economist with the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California.
If you simply don't have paperwork to get a job after you graduate, there's less incentive to pursue a formal education.
Hayes and other experts say many kids who grow up in the U.S. without legal status are confined to lower-paying jobs. He says it limits their potential and the state economy. Hayes says California will face a deficit of more than 1 million college-educated workers by 2030.
We need all of the young people that we can get who are inclined to pursue higher education.
I started thinking of becoming a high school teacher. I think a high school teacher in a charter school just like this one.
Daphne says a big motivation to go to college is her parents. She wants to help support them. Her dad is a gardener, and on Sunday mornings, Daphne and her dad will get in his black truck, with his tools still in the back, and drive to wealthier neighborhoods. They'll spot big houses with manicured lawns.
So my dad's always like, oh, I want one of those, you know, one of those houses. One of these days, you know, we're going to have a house like that.
Daphne says it's their American dream. In San Jose, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
All right, with the end of Veep and Game of Thrones, HBO has a huge hole to fill on their schedule. Well, how about a teen drama with graphic nudity, violence, and drug use? Yeah, HBO is really pushing the envelope on their latest project, and some scenes actually got pushback from their own executives. Coming up, find out how the cable network is hoping to continue the euphoria of the Game of Thrones era. That's ahead when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Spectrum News One, where talk meets action, where politicians meet constituents, where issues meet understanding. Join hosts Alex Cohn and Amrit Singh for Inside the Issues on Spectrum News One, a nightly political show that takes you inside the issues affecting you, your family, and your community. Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. Game of Thrones is gone, so what's HBO's next move? Well, an explicit show aimed at young audiences seems to be part of the plan. Plus, Roman Polanski and the Academy duke it out in court. Let's go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is here to walk us through all the Hollywood news. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, let's start with Euphoria. That's the new HBO series premiering this Sunday, starring Zendaya.
At some point, you make a choice about who you are and what you want.
Hey, I'm Rue. I'm an addict.
Now, this show is supposed to give us a window into what it's like to grow up in 2019. Rebecca, what's the show's reputation so far?
I think its reputation so far is as a show that parents will hope and pray is wildly inaccurate. This may be the most explicit TV show ever about teen life, according to a piece by my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Bryn Sandberg. Critics, including the Parents Television Council, say that it appears to be overtly, intentionally marketing extremely graphic adult content, sex, violence, profanity, and drug use to teens and preteens.
Yikes. That reminds me of that movie in the 90s called Kids. You remember that one?
I do remember Kids, yeah.
Yeah, that had a similar reaction. A lot of parents, a lot of people pushed back on that because it showed kids in very adult and grown-up situations. Now, in terms of executives and pushback, what kind of pushback is it getting?
Well, as explicit as what made it on the air is, the executives did push back at some scenes. One was a graphic childbirth scene. Another was a locker room scene that was deemed to have too many penises in it.
Oh, all right. Well, there you go.
They drew the line at, you know, somewhere between 30 and 60.
Yeah, it's hard to ignore. I mean, the giant Game of Thrones sized hole in HBO's programming. So I'm wondering if Euphoria is a peek at maybe HBO's strategy to maybe grow a new type of audience.
It is, in a way. I mean, Netflix has done a great job of reaching young adult audiences, and HBO wants those viewers too, and wants them to have the kind of affinity for the brand that people your age and my age do, especially since HBO's mandate under its new parent, AT&T, is to ramp up content to compete with all of these new streaming rivals, not just Netflix.
I'm wondering, are other studios going after younger audiences in the same way HBO is trying to? Can we expect maybe more shows like this in the future?
Well, everyone is always going after younger audiences, and they try different techniques. This seems to be HBO's, but it's sort of an adage, a well-worn adage in Hollywood, that you're always looking to get your sort of next audience on board, the next generation.
Yeah, and some critics and parents say the show is a little too sensational. How are our showrunners and actors defending it?
Well, the creator is Sam Levinson, who's the 34-year-old son of director Barry Levinson. He wrote all 8 episodes based on his own past struggles with addiction. And so realism is really his defense of it.
Yeah, and this is the kind of show, Rebecca, that's either going to terrify parents into not letting their kids see it, and I don't imagine that it's really aimed for anyone that's, you know, just barely a preteen or anything like that, but I guess that's the worry, right, is that somehow kids will wind up finding a way to see it.
Right, and because Zendaya is the star and her audience tends to be very young, I think there's an assumption that young audience will seek her out in this new space.
All right, staying with young audiences, let's move on to something that's occupying their time far more than any streaming service or social media. And I'm talking about the Battle Royale video game Fortnite. Rebecca, give us some context here. How many people play this game?
More than 250 million people play Fortnite. 82% of them are under age 35. The company makes about $2.4 billion in annual revenue from all of these players. And I will say, every year around the Oscars, I have a stress dream. And this year's stress dream was that Fortnite won Best Picture.
Really?
Which I think perhaps reflects the extent to which this phenomenon in entertainment is sort of affecting us all.
It's crazy. I mean, one of the things we found out over the last few years is that among young millennial professional athletes, like Major League Baseball players that are in their 20s, they have a lot of downtime. So do NBA players in their 20s. They're playing Fortnite all the time, enough that some people are worried that it's maybe hurting their forearms so they can't throw a baseball.
Oh my gosh.
That's the Boston Red Sox are an
Fortnite
example of that.
Fortnite injuries are the new thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's who is playing Fortnite. What about the time they spend playing it? How much time are they doing that?
Well, according to the National Research Group, Fortnite players spend about 21% of their free time with the game. 53% of the people who respond to the survey who are between ages 10 and 12 play Fortnite weekly. That's a lot more than those who say they use Facebook or Instagram regularly.
And earlier this year, the musician DJ Marshmello hosted an in-game concert that drew 10 million viewers. I mean, this sounds, Rebecca, like it could be the future of social media.
If it is, am I finally going to have to learn some of those dances?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel wildly out of touch as someone without kids. So if this is the future, I really need to investigate a little bit.
You got to dive into that social space, Rebecca.
Dive in.
Get in on all the hip things that are happening. All right, so let's end on news about director Roman Polanski. He and the Academy are kind of duking it out in court a bit over the director's expulsion from the awards group. What's going on there?
Well, in April, you may recall the director filed a suit saying that the Academy violated its policies by voting him out because the group didn't allow him to make his case. This week, the Academy responded in court and said that after Polanski complained about not being given a fair hearing, he was invited to submit written information relevant to concerning whether or not he should stay a member of the group. Apparently, he submitted 400 pages of supporting documents, including a copy of the documentary Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, and a video statement he recorded addressing the Academy's board.
What's the Academy's stance on all this?
They say their process was fair and reasonable. They also, you may remember, booted Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. So far, Polanski is the only person to push back on their sort of post-Me Too vetting of their membership.
Now, you mentioned that documentary Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired as part of his defense that he's been using. Let's take a listen.
He didn't perceive having intercourse with a 13-year-old girl is against the law.
The fact of Polanski leaving the country seems to have eclipsed what actually happened to the system of justice.
The judge was enjoying the publicity, and he didn't care about what happened to me, and he didn't care about what happened to Polanski.
How is he using this movie, this film, as part of his argument?
Well, the documentary lays out the legal case that surrounded Polanski when he fled the U.S. after admitting to the statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl in 1977. And it deals a lot with the way publicity influenced the legal system. Polanski has said that he left the country because the judge who was handling his case decades ago promised him he'd only serve 90 days of a psychiatric evaluation, but instead he was going to get sentenced to 50 years in prison. So it's kind of a deep dive into his court case and the problems surrounding it, which Polanski apparently think is sympathetic enough that the Academy Board should consider it.
Let's get in one more bit of Polanski news. There was a secret screening of footage for potential buyers for his next project at Cannes this year. What do we know about that, Rebecca?
Right. This is a $25 million movie called An Officer and a Spy. It stars Jean Dujardin, who's the actor from The Artist, playing Captain Alfred Dreyfus, who was a French-Jewish soldier wrongly accused of spying for the Germans. Really interesting story, obviously, a subject area that Polanski has explored before in The Pianist. At Cannes, there was interest from international buyers, but domestic buyers for audiences here in the U.S. were saying that he's just not someone they can market here.
Yeah, I can't imagine that any U.S. distributor would take a chance on that, right?
That's what they told our reporters at the festival. It's interesting. It wasn't that long ago that Roman Polanski was accepting an Oscar at the Academy Awards. So it just goes to show you how much in the culture has changed in the last few years.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the entertainment biz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
In a rock and roll band, the drummer is typically lowest on the totem pole. I mean, the lead singer gets most or all the love. They're up front for everyone to see. Next, it's lead guitar. They can be as loved or as famous as the singer. Then, way in the back, sometimes really hard to see, is a reliable old drummer. Bands run through drummers almost more than any other musician. Coming up, a local group of drummers who are anything but just part of the background. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Taiko drumming is a Japanese tradition that goes back more than 500 years. And if you aren't familiar, it sounds just like this. The taiko instrument has been part of Japanese music and dance for centuries, but in the last 60 years, it's been brought to the main stage. Recognized for its dynamic quality, taiko drumming is powerful, visceral, physical, and loud. In Southern California, the taiko tradition recently reached a milestone. It was here in Los Angeles in 1969 that taiko drumming began spreading all over North America. Take-Two contributor Beto Arco spent the last couple of weeks attending rehearsals and interviewing taiko groups and brings us this story of a community-building musical art form.
In the basement of the Higashi Honganji Buddhist Temple in Little Tokyo, a group of more than 40 drummers, ages 10 to mid-50s, rehearse the opening piece of the show they'll be performing this Saturday at the Ford Theater in L.A. There are three groups rehearsing today: Taiko Project, Bombu Taiko, and the youth group Kitsune Taiko. Hali Fukawa is a member of that last group. She's 15 and has been playing taiko for more than 7 years.
It's just something that's so powerful, and I think a lot of the times, especially in society, that women aren't really encouraged as much to be powerful. And so taiko, you know, hitting the drum, showing energy, showing emotion, it's something that's, like I said, it's so addictive.
At today's rehearsal, women do indeed make up the majority of the performers, about two-thirds. Women's participation in taiko goes back 50 years, when it began taking root in Los Angeles. The original taiko drums came to L.A. as part of the Buddhist tradition, but it wasn't practiced much.
Each temple would have one taiko drum that they would use pretty much just once a year at a summer festival called Obon. And they would play it at this festival to remember one's ancestors and to dance in this idea of joy.
Brian Yamami is executive director of Taiko Project.
But back in the late 60s, early 70s, some members of the Sanshin Buddhist Temple, they pulled out this drum and they just kind of looked at each other and said, hey, we should play this more than once a year. And they just started banging on it. And a few hours later, they're sweaty, their hands were bleeding. And they said, let's do this more often.
At the Sanshin Temple, a few blocks west of the USC campus, an audience of more than 100 is joining Kinara Taiko's 50th anniversary performance.
This is the Sanshin Buddhist Temple's social hall, and this is where pretty much the development of taiko and our particular style of taiko began.
That's Johnny Mori, one of the founding members of Kinara Taiko. Mori says the taiko story is the universal story of immigrants.
Because of our parents' sacrifice, during the war and after the war, we were given the opportunity that allow us to explore our own culture and develop our own, and to understand and study Japanese culture, but also give us a situation so that we could develop our own Japanese-American culture, or American culture, which we would like to say.
Back at the Higashi Honganji Buddhist Temple in Little Tokyo, during the rehearsal of the three groups, Lisa Shimamoto takes the lead with an opening call to more than 40 taiko drummers. Shimamoto is 57 years old and lives in Monterey Park. She joined Bombo Taiko in 2002.
My nieces were playing taiko in Monterey Park, so they started. I was taking them to their events, because almost every other weekend I had to take them to practice, or I had to drive them to a gig. I bring them home, and they said, oh, Auntie, you should try it one day. So that's what I did.
Anyone can play taiko. Age or background doesn't matter.
Well, I'm not Japanese myself. I found taiko through my love of music, but, you know, I've really come to love the traditions and the culture behind it and how it's changing in the U.S. as well.
Jen Bake has been with Taiko Project since 2004.
It's great because, you know, it kind of gives us a way to be involved with something and create music and be a part of, learn more about the cultures.
Yeah, for here in Los Angeles, it seems to me it's a little bit more wide open right now. Like there's no certain restrictions. There's no one person here saying you need to do this way or that way.
That's Masato Baba, the artistic director of Taiko Project. For his part, Baba says he wants to continue teaching taiko the way he learned it from his parents.
I definitely think that preserving the culture and the music of taiko is important. And so, you know, as much as I can, I try to teach that way to our students and hold on to those traditions as much as possible.
For 15-year-old Hali Fukawa of the youth group Kitsune Taiko, she says there's something special about the community she's been a part of for 7 years.
The thing that sets us apart from everybody else is our synergy and how well we work together and how much energy is just on that stage. And I really hope that people coming to watch for the first time will walk away and just say, like, wow, that was amazing. Like, I felt like I was up there with them.
The seed that was planted 50 years ago by both Kinara Taiko in Southern California and Taiko Dojo in the Bay Area has spread across North America. Today, there are more than 200 taiko groups in the U.S. and Canada. This Saturday at the Ford Theater, Taiko Project will be joined by Bombo Taiko and Kitsune Taiko. Together, they're proof that this tradition is alive and well at home. For Take Two, I'm Beto Arcos.
All right, if you missed any part of the show today, first off, what's wrong with you? We're on at 2 o'clock every day. Come on, make an effort. All right, but if you did, you could always download the Take 2 podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Twitter, at Take 2. That's at Take 2. You can find me there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.